Well, a lot of people have reported extraterrestrial contact. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, into the millions, perhaps. In a moment, we'll be talking with two special people. For the first half, Robert Perella joins us. He's the internationally acclaimed author of The Divine Blueprint and his new revised edition of The Divine Architect. Later on next year, Extraterrestrial Contact will be coming out too. Robert's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Robert Perella. And of course, I mentioned he is a acclaimed author, The Divine Blueprint, The Divine Architect, Extraterrestrial Contact is due out next year. Now, here's the interesting part of this. 1977, he was taken aboard a spacecraft by three extraterrestrials. He was returned, sunburned, covered in some kind of honey oil-like substance, like Travis Walton was, by the way. And I'm going to have Robert tell us a little bit about what happened to him as we get into this tonight. Robert, welcome back.
Thanks, George. It's great to always be on Coast to Coast with you guys.
I always look forward to it. This gooey substance that you were covered with. I remember watching the Travis Walton story, the Fire in the Sky, and he was immersed in some gook. Was this the same kind of thing?
You know, it's hard to say. Travis and I are very similar. Both of our encounters happened 2 years apart. He in 75, me in 77. I just turned 60 years old 2 weeks ago. So this story is
happy birthday, belated.
Thank you. The story's been following me around kind of for a long, long time now. I didn't really think at the time that anything like this could really even happen. I was raised in a house where my mother definitely practiced metaphysics and spirituality, and we were aware of it. But really, I didn't expect it. And what looked like somehow the ceiling opened up. I was in the California-Nevada border there, and up near Heavenly Valley, of all places. And the whole ceiling just opened up into this arcing storm all around the room. It was deafening, and it looked like flashes of blue lightning and indigo, violet, purple, a deafening sound, almost like a freight train going through the living room. And suddenly these three, what looked like astronauts, appeared and caused that side of the house to drop away, and then took me through like a tunnel of light, which was very painful. And then when I was brought back, I was sort of lowered on, I'm speeding up the story here, but lowering, you know, myself down onto the bed. And in this arcing storm, these astronauts, you know, suddenly whatever they were had done with me, or when they were done, went up and disappeared, sealed the ceiling, and it was all over. And I laid there for about 2 hours in a complete shock, and I threw up over the side of the bed. And when I finally eventually made it to the bathroom and barely pulled myself up on the vanity, on the sink, I was sunburned from head to toe, and I was covered in like an oil-like substance. And, it caused me to lock myself in my apartment for about 3 months, and I didn't want to do anything like that ever.
I did not know you locked yourself in for that long.
Yeah, I went to work about 2 weeks later, and I didn't tell anybody about what happened because I didn't think anybody would believe it. And at the same time, I wasn't really at that time sure that I could say this was a close encounter of any kind, because I didn't really have the capacity even quite to say that. I thought it was some strange manifestation. It was later that I met up with Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the original guy that founded Project Blue Book. And he met me at, I was the one of the very first, I'm one of the oldest in the business. I was one of the very first contactees to show up there at the San Francisco Airport Hilton. And there was a very young Richard Hoagland. Nobody knew who he really was. There was a very young Stanton Friedman. He was definitely making his mark with the extraterrestrial science. And there was J. Allen Hynek, and there was William Shatner, and they wanted to talk to me about this. And that's what started it. And I didn't go public until 1993, and from there it never stopped.
Did you think at any time that you were losing it, that you're going nuts?
Well, you know, George, I don't know that the mind has room for something like this when it happens, because it causes, a lot of people have had something similar to this. And then at first you know, depending on what you know about spirituality and depending on maybe on how grounded you are and how healthy you are, what your previous experience is with trauma, abuse, or whatever, you're going to react to it differently. For me, I was a healthy young man. I just didn't think anything like that. I, honest to God, it took me a long time to really figure out until they said, look, you've had a close encounter of some kind, and this is very unusual. And then it was later that I met up with Travis, and we talked at length about both of our experiences, and, you know, and we both went public, you know, later on.
Well, what's been happening to people all around this planet is simply mind-boggling all by itself. Now, you've got a work coming out in 2016. Tell me about Extraterrestrial Contact.
Well, really, it's an offshoot of The Divine Architect,
okay.
a revised edition, which has a very large section in there about extraterrestrials. We, you know, people know me mostly from personal growth, anecdotes for living, behavioral science,
mm-hmm.
certainly.
And your music.
yeah, and my music, of course. And by the way, let me say, I love your last guest, Vincent Jenna. He was right on the money. I think he was just great, especially when he mentioned The Science of Mind, Ernest Holmes.
Oh, yeah.
Great book. And so, really, we just wanted to come out with something that was new and fresh, that offered up kind of what's happening today, and that really, hopefully, connects people. Because lots of people are coming out and saying, you know, that something like this is happening. I mean, we're living in extraordinary times. I mean, I always like to say that we're really trepsing through the vast and sweeping changes in consciousness, you know, And we're living in a world of fantastic change. I mean, whether it's international and domestic policy, the war in the Middle East, or the refugees of Syria and Hungary, the 25% drop in the yuan last week in China, $17 trillion debt, and the NDAA, and finally the cherry on the cake. What are we going to do about the extraterrestrials? And so I talked to a lot of people about why, you know, what they think has happened. And they find me in one form or another, and I thought, you know what, I do need to have a new publication. We do need to share this and talk this and make this really for the people.
You know, Stephen Bassett truly believes disclosure's right around the corner. I'm still not sure, Robert. How about you?
Well, my feeling on it, you know, has always been that it's kind of happening all around us. It's a real funny thing. It's kind of being poured into us, I like to say. And what I mean when I say that is that it's almost like for the people that are waiting for an absolute disclosure to happen, there's that aspect where, you know, the government may come forth and the Defense Department may, you know, finally say there's something happening. But unfortunately, with that comes fear, and fear dictates a pull on people's resources, which is, of course, I hate to say it, but it does go back to even a money question, because when people are in fear, they pull their money from the market.
True.
What's happening is disclosure is kind of happening in a multitude of different ways. It's actually it's happening to individuals. It's people are starting to slowly wake up to the idea by seeing it on Facebook daily, seeing Instagrams, television programs, motion pictures. You know, the powers that be, the Defense Department and everything else, has a culture and a society to protect, and they don't want to upset really anything within that. So, but disclosure kind of is, we're sort of merging into it, whether a lot of people like it or not. Some people know that it's here, and that ETs are here, and that they're flying through our skies daily, and that they have a vested interest in us, while the others don't have a clue.
No. Why aren't we getting the kind of ET contact cases that we used to get in the 60s?
Well, I think in a lot of ways we have a lot of testimony that certainly is
and I'm not talking about sightings. I'm talking about actual contact. I mean, in the old days, during the infancy of ufology,
yeah.
they seemed to have this incredible contact with people. You know,
yeah.
whether you believed Adamski or not in his trips to Venus
yeah.
and stuff, but we don't hear that anymore.
You know, I think it still is quite rare. I don't know really why they choose certain individuals. It's rare. I mean, for people that claim that that's happened to them, then they're in one category of, well, yeah, maybe it happened, and maybe it's sort of an embellishment, or it's an idea, or it's a dream. And then there's the authentic cases, and the authentic cases, are actually fairly rare, where it's really been physically taken aboard, like the Travis Walton, the Adamskis, Betty and Barney Hill, all the original cases like that. They're still actually quite rare, but I do think that they're definitely making their presence known, and certainly the crop circles, and certainly in a multitude of different ways from these light rods in the sky, which have been appearing now in the last 5 weeks. Have you seen these
Oh,
gigantic
yes,
rods
strange
of
story.
light?
Very strange.
It is, and I think that they're actually quite real. And I'm going with the fact that this is probably more of an ET thing. This is some kind of vested interest in us. I don't think that this is necessarily a government thing. There's a set of photographs on my Facebook page that I just put up tonight that I thought was kind of interesting because there was some evidence that they might be quite real because of the shadow and because of the types of pictures that they put together to show that, yeah, there is something. We actually had one here near the Golden Gate Bridge, and it was very brief. And most people look at it and just in sheer disbelief, and then they go into denial and they go, no, I didn't really see that, or whatever that was. It was an aberration or something.
Robert, you had earlier said that the three that visited you looked like astronauts. To me, that sounds like they were in some kind of setup with helmets and everything else.
Yeah, there's probably more cases out there, George. I know that Jeff Grinshaw took a photo of one in 1973 in Falkville, Alabama. That's the photo I actually show on my website at robertperella.com. Clarissa Bernhardt is another one in New York who had a number of contacts with them and actually had telepathic communication with them and still does, I think, to a degree. And then there was my case also. They were about 8 feet tall. They wore like visors on their helmet. They had like orange antennas on top of their helmet. I saw no faces. The suit itself even seemed to be alive. And I think it's almost, and there was this arcing storm around with flashes of like, what looked like blue lightning and indigo coming off of the suits themselves. And to be in the presence of something like that, I would love to say it was a beautiful experience and I saw the light.
Whatever it was.
That's not what my story was. It was quite painful and extraordinarily scary.
And you're convinced that some of these visitors are walking among us right now?
Yeah, there is what I call, we certainly have, people that claim that they're some kind of walk-in, but I like to think of there's a number of cases that they're like a blend. Do we have enough time to tell you the quick story about the strange
case?
Yeah,
you sure do.
Mr. D? A guy walks into my lecture years ago, very tall, emaciated guy, very light color, piercing blue eyes, long fingers, holds out what looked like a stone, and the stone itself glowed a very brilliant red on its own. And we were very taken back. And later on after my lecture, he handed me a set of hieroglyphics or some sort of drawings. And then I asked him, can I come and see you and talk to you in private because there were people around? And so he invited me to his house. I went to his house, sat down with him, and I realized he had these drawings all over the walls. And he explained that he had actually come into this body while it had been deceased for 3 days, and that he had stepped into it. And I asked him, I said, well, do you do like readings or something? What do you do? Can you tell people about their health or something? Or is there some kind of abilities you have? And he said, I can do that. And I said, can you tell me about my dad? Because he was dying at the time. And so he said, yeah. I said, well, can you do a reading on him? And he said, well, yes, I can do that. And we sat there for about 20 minutes, and he didn't say a word. He had his eyes closed, and he had a pen in his right hand, and suddenly his hand went into a spasm, and it drew out like what looked like three graphs. And then he opened his eyes, and he said, here's your reading. Hmm. And he handed it to me, and I said, well, wait a minute. I thought you were going to say something. And he said, well, you asked me to do a reading on your father as to his health. He said, that's it. He said, take that to a nurse and she'll tell you how he's doing. That's the reading. I took it to a registered nurse at a hospital in Mountain View, California, and she looked at it and she said, well, it's a perfect electrocardiogram. She said, not only that, it's very detailed. It includes the systolic and the diastolic. She said, are you trying to tell me that a man did this by hand? And I said, well, he did it with his eyes closed. And he said, well, this is his lungs, and it shows palpitations in it. This is his heart. It shows erratic heartbeat. And this is his kidneys, and it showed that his kidneys were very toxic. She said, I don't think a person could draw an electrocardiogram. I don't think that's possible. Yet this is very detailed. And so I got to know this guy a little bit, and he started describing to me that some people actually give up their body and then are kind of a shared experience where another entity may take over for a while before they decide to give that particular vehicle up, and that there's only, they're rare cases, but they are here.
When you talk about redefining the experiencer, what does that mean?
This particular experience with him?
Well, anyway, that phrase itself, what does that mean?
Redefining the experience?
Yes.
In which case?
Well, the subtitle of your book. What does that mean?
Well, you know, this is, again, it's looking at redefining, you know, taking it case-by-case basis and trying to separate myth from misconception. We're always defining cases where, you know, in what sort of categories we should try to put these people in. I mean, what do we do with these particular stories? And so we were trying to write from the book that we were trying to, you know, separate some of the people that were really fantasizing and some of the people that had a really authentic experience and everything, and also what new cases are looking like, because some people are claiming that they not only get taken aboard a spacecraft, but they have an integrated relationship even with, you know, these various entities.
Are these experiences changing based on what you have been led to believe?
I don't know that they've always been changing. I think they've always been there. I think we just keep discovering that which has always been, and there's just more and more. And more people are coming out of the closet. You know, if they get the idea that you're some kind of authority or you have a book, you know, they're going to find you. And they find me and they find other, you know, authors, all the group that goes down there to contact in the desert. And they find us and they just, they usually come out of the closet and they say, I have something to tell you. You know, and this happens actually, strangely enough, when people are getting ready to pass away. Also, when there's people that are really have been given notice that they're getting ready to leave, and they want to tell a secret. They want to tell something they've been holding on to for a long time, but they never felt comfortable that they could tell their family. And that's another whole category of people that are coming out when people are just ready to depart to say they had a traumatic experience, but they just couldn't come out all those years.
There are a lot of people, Robert, who believe that ETs are demonic. How do you answer that?
Well, I don't think all are have our best interests at mind, George. I really don't. I've seen people that claim they've had contact with an entity like that. You know, years ago we used to study resident entities, and these were in interdimensionals that somehow attached themselves to the field of a particular individual, and the person is filled with, you know, some really dark ideas. So I think that whether they're extraterrestrials or whether they're Earth-based disincarnates, that's a very fine line. But I definitely think that, you know, not all of them have our best interest in mind. Although I think at the end of the day, we're probably quite protected, because they have a vested interest in here, and we have not seen any real negative aspects regarding the ETs.
You know, David Jacobs, of course, is a believer that they're out to do no good.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think they have a very vested interest to birth the Earth into a larger expression. But that doesn't mean that they're all good. Some of them have other agendas on the planet also. But I don't think, in some ways, I think they, I mean, they have the technology to transcend the incredible distance it would even take to get here, George. So some of them, when they master those abilities, are probably living in a universal and spiritual law that they understand, and that they're allowed here somehow. But there's a governing body over all this, too. I do believe that whether you look at the Sanskrit or the Gita, it does talk about an angelic presence that's here, that's an overriding force that's sort of protecting things here.
I think so, too. Robert, stay with us. We're going to go to Lorian Fenton in a moment. She, of course, is an investigator and researcher. We're going to get her take, and then Robert comes back for phone calls later on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back. Well, next up, as we talk about extraterrestrials and contact, Lorian Fenton joins us, and I'll tell you all about her in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Do you remember that H1N1 scare in the summer of 2009? Well, Lorian Fenton came down with pneumonia during that situation. She became active with the San Francisco Bay Area UFO community after this episode, and she almost died from it. It was a near-death experience, and that propelled her into doing the work that she really likes. Now, she also founded the not-for-profit Conscious Community Events, And she's been a producer of Mind Control Summits, and here she is on Coast to Coast. There's her own show, too, by the way. Hey, Lorianne, good to have you with us.
Thank you, George. I can't believe I'm on Coast to Coast.
You sure
are. This is so exciting.
Here it is. Hey, tell us a little bit about this near-death experience.
Oh, my gosh. Well, do we have 5 hours?
We can squeeze that out for you.
Let's see. It started with me getting a fever and a cold in the end of July in 2009. By the first week of August, it's not getting better. My temperature is rising to 104, and I am in bad shape. I go to the ER, and they say, oh, you've got pneumonia. Come back in a few days if the antibiotics don't work or what have you. A few days later, my roommate finds me on the floor, and I'm screaming, oh, get the geese out of my chest. Tell the babies to stop crying.
Oh, God, you're having delusions.
I was having delusions because I was hearing the sound of so much liquid or fluid or whatever was in my lungs making high-pitched noises that I thought it was geese and babies. So here I end up at the ER, and the doctor that treated me a few days before saw me coming down the hall, and he took one look at me, George, and he threw me on a gurney. And this is a very gross part. I hate saying it on radio, but they
be careful.
Yeah, they cut a hole in my carotid artery, and they put an 8-inch pipe down into my heart.
Oh,
and it had three. Yeah, I swear, George, my blood oxygen was 1.
It should be 90.
Yeah. The nurse thought I was dead. I mean, literally, they couldn't believe I was still, you know, mobile enough to actually get to the gurney. So in this process, they put this port down into my neck. They have three little prongs coming off of it. And the only thing I remember out of all that at that point is that there are three nurses standing around me on this gurney being rolled to the ICU, and they're all squeezing bags of different colored antibiotics into my neck, into this port.
Just pumping it into you.
Yeah, they're pumping it into me because they thought I was going to die any minute. I mean, it's that serious. But while I was in the hospital, I had some amazing encounters with, I don't know what they were. I don't know if they were ghosts. I don't know if they were extraterrestrials. I have no idea what these people were. But there's one girl in a wheelchair that kept wheeling herself up to the bed and bumping into it and just backing up and bumping into it. And she had dark eyes, and she was about 12. And I knew she was dead, and I just kept asking her, why are you bothering me? And she didn't respond. So that was kind of weird. And then the second night I was in, there was a woman laying over the top of me that looked like myself with totally white hair. And she was wrapped in a shroud, like the Jewish tradition of wrapping a person in a shroud when they bury them. And she was laying over the top of me, pressing on me, and she kept telling me telepathically, I am the pneumonia. I am the pneumonia. And I kept going, oh, no, this is just so freaky. But after she laid on me that night, my fever broke, and I got better. So it was very interesting. I kind of akin her to an entity that came from the pneumonia that may have turned into a good spirit or alien or angel or some type of being that helped cure me. So it was really touch and go. I mean, they brought in the priest and the whole bit, George. I was ready to go.
You were ready to depart. Now, let's go way back when you were a kid. You had an experience.
Boy.
Something happened to you that has really changed your life. Tell us about that.
It did. You know, I was about 7 years old. We finally figured it out. You know, I was 60. It must have been 1964. I was in the second grade. And it was a summer going into the second grade, first to second grade for me. And my grandparents took myself and my two younger sisters to the Multnomah County Fair. I grew up in Portland, Oregon. And back in the 60s, you know, the big thing at the fair, George, was the animals, the 4-H animals.
Oh, yeah, people love those.
Oh, yes, and we did, too, because we had a little farm, and we had donkeys and chickens and, you know, little animals, and it was quite fun. And I was holding a rabbit. We went up to the hutches, and there was a prize-winning rabbit, and I just fell in love with this rabbit, George. My grandparents walked around with my two sisters for about an hour, and I just sat in this one spot holding this rabbit. And when my grandparents came back and said, we've got to go, you know, put the rabbit back, we got to go, I said, no, I love the rabbit. I want to take it home with me. And they said, no, you can't. And they actually spoke to the young couple who had the rabbit and said, can we buy it? And they said, no, it's our breeding rabbit. It just won first place. No, 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 it's never going to happen. And I was so distraught, George. I got in the car, and I don't know if you remember this, but back in the good old days, there were bucket seats. You know, I say lovingly, kids weren't strapped in like they were going to the moon every time they went to the grocery store back then. So I was leaning over the bucket seat, and in one ear I'd talk to my grandmother, and the next ear I'd slide over and talk to my grandfather, and I kept saying, oh, I really want a rabbit, I really want a rabbit. And my grandfather kept saying one thing, George. He kept saying, I'm not building a hutch. There's no way we're having a rabbit. I'm not building that hutch. And my grandmother just kept saying, oh, come on, let her have a rabbit. He goes, no, no, I'm not building a hutch. So I'm sitting there, and I remember this very distinctly, George. I went into this state of very quiet, just a state of sheer bliss and peacefulness, huh. And I imagined the rabbit at the house waiting for me. I know that sounds crazy. People laugh at me when I say this.
As long as he wasn't 7 feet tall. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. So I'm imagining this rabbit, and I'm really in a very deep meditative state of love. Now that I'm older, I know where I was at that time. But, you know, I'm 7 years old. I don't know what's going on. I just know I want a rabbit, and I really was being very genuine about it in the moment. And wouldn't you know, we drove up to the driveway, and we had a gate, because we lived on a farm, and he had to open the gate to get to the farm. And we could see a black spot on the other side of the gate. My grandfather gets out of the car, and he's looking at my grandmother, and he opens the gate, and he walks up to this rabbit, I swear to you, George, completely identical to the one we just left at the county fair a half an hour ago.
How strange was that?
Yeah, and it just lets him pick it up, and he walks over to the car. My two sisters are clapping and screaming, oh, we got a rabbit. And I'm just standing there, and he hands it to me, and he goes, I guess I'm building that hutch after all. And, you know, that's the story. But, you know, I forgot about it for like 50 years. I was 53 before I ever thought about it again. And now it's, you know, I'm 58. I just turned 58. Robert Pearl and I have a birthday. We celebrate one day apart from each other.
Well, happy birthday to all of you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we had a great time. We had a party, and we even toasted you, George. I just want you to know that.
Well, as long as you didn't toast me on a barbecue grill, that's okay.
I know. I think we were doing margaritas about that time.
So how did this UFO experience occur, though, for you?
Oh, my God.
What happened?
Okay. See, now, this is weird. This is why I am very adamant about experiencers, and this is why Robert Pearl and I are starting to talk about redefining what the experiencers are. I'm just going to go sidetracking for just a second, and I'll get back to my UFO experience.
Okay.
Alan J. Hynek described the first kind, the second kind, the third kind of encounters or contact back in 67 or 72? I think it was 72, in his book UFO Experience.
And then the movie was made from his book.
Exactly, exactly. So we're sitting here, and it's now 2015. And Robert and I are sitting around a table after a UFO meeting. You know, up in Northern California, we are just avid UFO people up here. We have our MUFON meetings with Ruben Yarte. We have my MUFON meeting up in Petaluma. Cynthia Siegel has one up in Sacramento. There's a new one happening in Redding. And I think every weekend we're going to some kind of UFO thing. So anyhow, we talk constantly about this. And I put on conferences for UFO experiences and UFOCon and all these things. But we're sitting there after a meeting, and he says to me, he goes, you know, Hynek has never, it's never changed since Hynek. And I said, yeah, you're absolutely right. We've got to do something about this. So what we did is we sat down and we just started jotting notes, you know, on napkins, I think, at Harry's Hofbräu, you know, San Jose. And we came up with five new kinds of definitions that include all of the Hynek definitions, and I'll go into those later. But the reason we came up with those is because I looked at him and I said, hey, I've never really seen a UFO. I've never seen one, but I've had contact my entire life, so what does that make me? And I always thought my contact was with an angel, not an alien.
Hmm.
So what does that make
me? And do you still believe that, or did you change?
Oh, I absolutely believe it, and I think it's a higher dimensional form of alien, what we describe as an angel now. Absolutely. So, but my first contact and my first alien, I would say, experience, it happened to be at a conference that you spoke at in 2011. I'm not going to go into names and everything, but you were there, and that weekend changed my entire life, because on Saturday night, I went back to the room I was staying at. I was staying at an Airbnb home, so I had a bedroom and a bathroom and the whole bit.
Right.
I wasn't in a hotel.
Those are rentals, right, for people?
Well, yeah, I think they're rentals. You know,
yeah,
they're banning them in some cities now. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk politics and all kinds of things if we wanted to, but I'm going to try to stick to my story here. So I'm at this Airbnb, and I go back to the hotel, back to the room, and I'm with a traveling companion, and she walked into the other room, and I thought, oh my gosh, I haven't checked my email yet today. So I pop open my email, and I had a thought. Now, there was a time, and I'm going to go back 6 months. The woman I'm traveling with, she heard a helicopter come over my house on a phone call that we were having in May of that year, and it's now September. So I thought to myself, I wonder if she remembers the day the helicopter came over my house. And as I thought it, George, I swear to you, and I tell everybody this, and I even have pictures to prove it, of the room I was in at least, I heard a helicopter come over that house as loud as day. I mean, it was so loud, I thought it was going to shake the house down. And I'm flabbergasted, because then in that moment, George, I realized whoever is in contact with me can read every thought in every moment that I'm thinking.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. That happens.
It was so profound. But here's the kicker. I got enough nerve to walk over to the window to look up at this helicopter, right? I go to look out the window. There's no helicopter. What I'm seeing is three orange, and it's a dark red ember like a fire, and there are three orange lights in the sky very low in a triangle formation. I could not make out if it was a spaceship or not. I couldn't tell at all, but there's three lights in the sky, but they are not a helicopter.
Are you convinced, though, that they're angelic as opposed to extraterrestrial?
You know, I think they're one and the same, George. I think, you know, your first guest tonight, Vincent, I believe he defined it very well. He said that there are many different realms of dimensions.
Yeah, like 22, according to editor,
yeah.
Edgar Cayce. Yeah.
Edgar Cayce, correct. And I absolutely believe that we have 3D aliens among us, like the reptilians, the grays, the Nordics, you know, I can go on and on. You know, we have all of those. And I think they manifest on a 3D reality that is very close to ours. And I tell people what's really happening in my mind is that the veil between the dimensions is thinning because of the different frequencies, the Wi-Fi, the fiber optics, you know, all the things that we're doing to this worldly grid that we have of electromagnetism around the world, maybe even HARP, maybe even the chemtrails. I don't know what's doing it. But I think we are ascending in a very interesting way, that it's more chemical and electromagnetic in a very strange way. And what's happening is the veil, like I akin it to a standing in a room and we're circled by a curtain, and that curtain's getting thinner and thinner, and we're getting closer and closer to the curtain, so that the 3D aliens on the other side of the curtain can actually just walk through the curtain and talk to us.
Now, what you want to do now is you want to help contactees, don't you?
I do, because, you know, the funny part about helping them is that I think they need to be redefined. As we were talking about earlier, I think it's time. You know, it's been since 1972. Isn't it time we all get a new name for ourselves? And what I described them at, Robert and I wrote this down on the napkin, and this is the synopsis I kind of sent to you guys at Coast. I think it's very intriguing. We have all the contactees that, you know, have the extraterrestrial encounters that are positive, all the way from positive to neutral. And these people are seeing the praying mantis beings and the reptilians, but they're also seeing the ones that are more like Palladians and humans and what we perceive as angels. And those are the type of contacts that are fairly good. You know, people don't have a bad time with them, and they're getting good messages from these type of extraterrestrials. And I just think those kind of experiencers need to be defined as the people who are having great experiences and a good time, you know. And then the next definition that we came up with when we were writing on that napkin one night was that the abductee, And these are the people that are not having a good time. And these are people that are seeing a lot of the grays, the reptilians. They don't necessarily always see the Nordics or the angel
type. Right, and they're not volunteering for this either.
And they're not. And they're having babies, and they're having, you know, sex against their will. I mean, there's all kinds of adult things that we can't even talk about going on with these people that I just think it's sad that they're not getting their own kind of definition, because we've been lumping them all together. I have so many friends, and you know Melinda Leslie, and I mean, it goes on and on. All these women that have had, Kim Carlsberg, I mean, it goes on and on. There's just so many women that have had these profound experiences that they can't say to me, Lorian, it was so much fun.
Well, what would you consider yourself, more of a researcher now than anything?
I think I am becoming a researcher whether I want to or not, and also an advocate. I would say that I'm becoming more of an advocate for everybody. I'm becoming a voice for them. I'm trying to anyhow. And they're very happy about it, I got to say, everybody I talk to. I do have radio talk show that I do once a week that they all come on, you know, just like they come on your show.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all good friends, as you know. And they're just so happy that somebody's out there putting on events and doing things that are helping redefine the whole structure of how we're presenting them to the regular population. Because, for example, I put on something, and I have an ad out on Coast to Coast AM, you know. I put an ad out there, and people that are listening in their car that don't know anything about it, they can be kind of like, whoa, who are these weird, you know, who are these strange people, right?
And you know what? That's why we started what we're calling ParanormalDate.com, for people who can't meet other people who understand this.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I love what you're doing. I want to talk to you about that further in the next hour if we could. I think it's wonderful. Yeah. But anyhow, so I want to get something out there that brings more mainstream people into what we're doing. I'm kind of, you know, refocusing how it's being announced, how it's being talked about, and not making these people seem like they're some kind of strange human being, you know, because Betty and Barney Hill, way back in the day, got a really bad rap, and, you know, there weren't very many people that said wanted to say, oh, I'm their best friend.
And they were one of the first to really
go
public.
And then the Andreases came along, and then we had all the other people that followed in their footsteps. You know, Whitley Strieber, God bless his soul.
Yeah.
He was the bravest guy out there at the time because, I mean, how many other people would have been talked about?
He's still out there doing
this. He still is, and he's doing an amazing job. And, you know, my hat's off to that guy. You know, I couldn't even imagine what it would be like. See, at least I'm out there for these people now. I can call them up. I can say, look, and we're doing something, and we're going to get this out to the public, and we're going to get it, you know, much more on the forefront. And I got to tell you something, George, you are the king of this because you've been doing this for years. You're the guy out there every night doing it. And, you know, it's not an easy world. People think that what we do is so easy and so fun and, you know, all this, but I got to say, and I'm going to say something personal I would probably never say, but I'm doing it anyhow. My family won't even talk to me, some of them, about what I do because it's just so bizarre.
They just think, they think you're too far out there, don't they?
Exactly. So, you know, people just don't get that this is not something we choose to do. It's more of a calling, and I absolutely believe that whatever these other dimensional creatures are out there in this other realm, they have placed us here to make a difference in the world, George. I think you're one of these people, and I think that I am, and I think Robert Peral is, and I think all the people who listen to Coast are on that cusp, too. They're out there. They're making a difference for all of us.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take phone calls with you, Lorian, and also Robert. We'll have him come back as well as we talk about these experiences that people have had. And if you think you've been abducted, you might want to share your story with us as well. Now, all the websites, of course, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, so we make it really easy for you. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and definitely download our free apps in the Apple Store or in the Google Play Store. Just grab them and put them on your phone.